Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and we know you're eager to get out and dig in the garden, but it's not quite time for that yet. However, it is time to go out and get some work done. We're going to talk about spring pruning this hour, and of course, later on, we'll also take your questions about the plants and trees in your life at Iowa Public Radio. Or Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org and 866-780-9100. With me right now, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Hello, Aaron.
Good morning.
And Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
And I suppose we should start with the question that we talk about so often. Is it still okay to prune oak trees?
Okay. Well, the best time is basically winter, December, January, February. The worst time basically is April through July. That's the worst time. The risk is highest during that period. So March is a transitional month. It goes from being quite good to a risky thing to do. So if they were to do it now, I would suggest they immediately paint the pruning surface with a latex house paint. That's kind of added insurance, just in case. Because okay. If you do that, you're basically sealing it so that the insect is not attracted to that pruning cut. So if they do it, I want to do it as soon as possible and then paint that pruning surface.
All right. The window of opportunity is closing.
Yes, very quickly.
All right. Now let's talk about spring pruning. And we do all have a lot of work that we could get out in the yard and do. Let's start with shade trees. What should we be thinking about right now?
Well, for a lot of the shade trees out there, you can be pruning right now. Typically, we say late winter, early spring is the best time to do that stuff. And this is pretty much that window. What you're looking for in these trees is to, now that the leaves aren't on it, it's one of the reasons why this time of year is so great. There's no leaves on it. So you can see things like dead branches. You'll want to remove those if you see any. The next thing I always look for are things that are rubbing or crossing that would open up a wound because they're touching each other. And you would want to decide maybe to remove one of those in those kinds of situations. And then I look at the tree from a more kind of functional standpoint, like is there a branch that whaps me every time I try to walk around the tree?
When I mow. Something,
yeah. Yeah. Hopefully you're not getting that close to the tree when you mow, but it happens, of course. And so, you know, that's what I'll go to next to try to clean up the tree. I think the other thing that's really important is if you have younger trees, is to be very diligent. The first 10 years of that tree, you can do more good to the long-term structure of the branches and the tree itself with proper pruning than any time after that. And it really is very important to watch for things like double leaders, to keep branches on as long as possible, lower on the tree. But once they get to be an inch or two in diameter, maybe a little bit bigger, depending on the size of the trunk, removing them at that time, that work that you do to those young trees early on will set you up for a wonderful tree, or the lack of work will set you up for a tree that will always be a little bit problematic.
So you need to go out, take a good look, and make a plan. Is there a danger of being overzealous, maybe cutting too much?
You can cut off too much, absolutely. Especially, you know, the rule, the general rule of thumb is to always never remove more than a third. That tends to apply more to shrubs than trees. For trees, I try to leave on as much as I can because the branches and the leaves are what feed the tree, and they need that stuff to grow. So if I don't have to remove it, I'm not going to. But things like double leaders, one of those things I want to remove because those two competing leaders create kind of a V shape in the tree that very easily breaks apart as the tree ages.
All right. Now, when you identify an area where you're like, okay, I need to do something about this, what kind of advice do you have for making the right cuts?
Yeah, the right cut is really important. Trees don't replace the damage that happens when you make a pruning cut. They seal it off or they wall it off. And so the right pruning cut leaves behind all of the stuff the tree needs to wall or seal off that wound so that decay doesn't spread throughout the tree. And so really proper cut is very important. And it's, you know, there are a lot of diagrams and sometimes a picture is worth a thousand words. But in general, what you're looking for are two structures at the base of the branch. There's a ridge. It kind of looks like a mountain range that forms as the bark kind of pushes together. And then at the end of the branch where it attaches, there is a slight swelling. And on every tree, both the ridge and that collar, that slight swollen area, might be difficult or easy to find. Certain species, it's real prominent, and other species, it's a little more difficult to see. But that is what you want to leave on the tree. That is where that work of walling or sealing off that wound happens. And if you make a flush cut, you remove all that, and it's harder for the tree to seal off that area, and you are more likely to see decay spread throughout the tree.
All right. Now, this is also a time of year when sap is flowing in a number of different shade trees. If you cut maple or birch or elm. Is that something to be concerned about when you make a cut, that it's like the tree is bleeding?
Yeah, it is like the tree is bleeding. And I think that's why we worry about it so much. But for the most part, it's not a big deal. Now, if it's dripping on your car while it's parked there, or if it's right in front of your sidewalk.
Definitely move your car.
Yeah.
But the important thing, it's not going to bleed to death.
No.
That's not going to happen. It doesn't really hurt the tree that much at all. So don't worry about it. Just kind of look away.
Yeah.
Move your car.
Yes.
So, and Richard, you had mentioned earlier with oak trees that, you know, when you're in this sort of in-between side or time, if you really need to make a cut, paint it with latex. With most shade trees, though, that kind of wound treatment is unnecessary, right?
Well, it used to be a very common practice 15, 20 years ago. You would go to the garden center. They have this black tarry substance as pruning paint, and you would very carefully do that. It doesn't do any good. It really doesn't. So don't use it. Just make a nice, clean pruning cut. And if you have to prune an oak sometime, basically in the spring or summer, use that latex house paint and
all
cover
right.
that.
And we've talked about shade trees. How about fruit trees?
There's no need to paint those either.
All right. But is this also the right time to?
Very good time, yes. Mm-hmm. You want to go out sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks before they start to leaf out. And with fruit trees, I'm looking for things like, for example, any suckers near the base of the trunk, take those out. Take out any branches that are growing inward rather than outward. Again, crossing branches possibly, dead branches, broken branches. And if you do that and you still have a very dense tree, then some maybe thinning of some of the smaller limbs.
All right. And when you do that, that seems like that would have a direct impact on your production this summer.
Well, it actually does improve the crop when you do some thinning, in that you get better light penetration. You're going to have fewer fruit. So hopefully they're going to be nice size, high quality. So actually it's beneficial to do that. If you don't do anything at all, you're going to get more fruit, a very dense canopy. You're going to not get very good light penetration, not as good situation.
All right, let's talk about shrubs. What kind of shrubs should we be thinking about pruning this time of year?
Basically most of them. Mm-hmm. And basically you have the main types. You do have a number of spring flowering shrubs, things like lilacs, forsythias, that type of thing. And depending on how much pruning needs to be done, you can do it now. For example, if you have a large neglected lilac or some other shrub that hasn't been pruned in many, many years, even though they bloom in the spring, I would prune them now or sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I would simply go out there and maybe very carefully select maybe 3, 4, 5 of the largest, oldest stems and cut those off near ground level. And then I would come back the following year and do the same thing, and over a period of 3 to 4 years, get rid of most of the old wood. But if you have a younger lilac, it's still very young, very vigorous, needs only maybe some light pruning, I would do that immediately after blooming. Therefore, you can enjoy the bloom and then do it.
All right. And we talked about a concern, perhaps, of being overzealous with your shade trees. Shrubs are a little more forgiving, aren't they?
Yeah. It's hard to kill a lilac. It really is. Spirea, really the same thing. So you're not going to do that. Just don't give them a haircut. A lot of people like to go out and just go prune them off maybe 4 or 5 feet above the ground, the whole thing.
We like to shape them.
Right, right. And if you do that with a lilac, they're not going to bloom at all this year. So try to be more selective.
All right. And you have a rule of thirds, right?
About a third, yeah.
So you can cut back about a third and you're going to be okay. But that will affect the flowering in the spring, right?
Right. But you'll still get some flowering because you're only taking out maybe a third at most. So the other two-thirds are still there. You'll still get plenty of flowers.
Now, with these long-neglected shrubs, you can, you know, really do some hard work pulling out maybe a third of the plant. When you're actually staying up to date, how much pruning do you think you need to do?
If you're doing it every year, very little. Maybe just one or two or three. It's not much at all. Usually it's something maybe that it's getting in the way of something or maybe hitting the house or something like that, and you just prune it out. No problem.
And, of course, for example, with lilacs, they're going to live a really long time. Do you always want to go for the oldest parts of the shrub?
Absolutely, when you're pruning, because they get to be almost tree-like in size. They can be like 3 to 4 inches in diameter. And those, you really need to kind of rejuvenate the plant, get rid of that old growth, some newer growth. That newer growth is going to be more vigorous. It's going to have heavier bloom. So you just want to keep it at a younger state where it keeps on blooming.
Plus, right. It'll be shorter, too, which a lot of people are looking for.
Right. Instead of 10 or 15, maybe 8 or 10.
How about shrubs that also fruit, like gooseberries, grapevines, things like that? Is it also time to be thinking about pruning those?
Yes. And with something like a gooseberry, the gooseberries tend to produce fruit on the younger canes or stems. And so if you have stems that are 6, 7 years old, they're not going to produce a lot of fruit. So if you have a well-established gooseberry, if you have a well-established blueberry, you want to remove the oldest stems or canes because they're not nearly as productive.
All right, and that's going to, again, improve your production.
Right.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes to answer your questions. With me today, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Giron and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Join the conversation, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today. You are welcome to join the conversation with your questions at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me, Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames, and Richard Giron, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist. And we'll start with a couple of email questions. This one's from Coralie in Fairfield. Our Stanley prune tree lost all its fruit 2 years in a row. Evidence suggests plum curculio. Pardon me if I said that wrong. We gathered all fallen fruit last year, but not in previous years. How do we control this? What beneficial nematodes would be effective, or would beneficial nematodes be effective? If so, when and how, and other measures you recommend?
At this point, it's hard to say exactly what it is. As far as the nematodes, no, I don't think that's going to be effective. I think what I would try would be to use a home orchard spray. And most garden centers have one. And they typically contain two different insecticides and a fungicide. They control a wide range of both insects and diseases. I would try that, follow labeled directions, and then if the problem reoccurs, then try to have it positively identified as far as the cause. They may have to send a sample into the plant diagnostic clinic, but if it's reoccurring, they really need to know exactly what's causing the drop.
All right. Here's a question from Kay in Johnston. I planted a few blackberries last spring. How do I prune them this spring?
Okay. Blackberries are kind of iffy in Iowa. What I would do is just go out in the next 2 or 3 weeks, and I would just prune out the dead wood. Most blackberries produce on the previous year's growth, And if you prune them off down to the ground, they're obviously not going to produce this year. So I would just prune out the dead wood and see what they do.
All right, let's get to the phones. 866-780-9100. Jeff is on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Calling about, we have a eastern redbud in our yard, and I've been told that it's kind of hard to keep them alive, and we've been doing pretty good for the last quite a few years, and I'm just wondering, because we've never pruned it or anything, and there's some branches that are kind of getting in the way of when we're mowing, mm-hmm. and just wondering, like, how low down can we go and which way to cut and everything?
Right. So redbud will always be a low branch tree. So you'll likely always kind of have to kind of jostle around it if you're mowing up to the trunk of the tree. If you have something that's really in the way, I mean, typically we recommend that you're not removing branches more than about 2 inches in diameter, especially on a smaller tree like that. It just takes longer for that to close up or seal over. A redbud tends to have a habit that will have some kind of V-shaped attachments. You're going to want to try to encourage that tree to have a single primary trunk as high up as you can go, unless it's purposefully a multi-stem tree. Sometimes it's sold that way, kind of like you often see birch. So you just kind of have to kind of gauge on what your preference is, but it will always be a more lower branched tree. So you may
have to
bigger mulch ring around it.
And oftentimes the tree does not have a perfectly shaped canopy.
No.
That's just their character. That is one thing they have. They may be a little bit lopsided or whatever, but that's perfectly fine.
It's part of the beauty.
And as far as growing it, if you have a cold, hardy tree, it should be fine. That's the biggest issue in Iowa is that these trees are grown typically from seed, and if they're grown from a southern seed source, they're not reliably hardy in Iowa. But if you have a hardy one, you're fine.
All right, Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. I can't wait to see the red buds in bloom this spring.
Another month or so.
Yeah, it's not going to be too long, really.
All right, let's go to Angela in Des Moines. Hi, Angela.
Hello. I've grown hydrangeas forever, and I've grown Annabelles forever. So arborescence, and I prune them down to the ground, everything, because they bloom on new wood. Well, a couple of years ago, I bought several PG types. And so I don't think I'm supposed to do the same thing to the paniculatas or the PG types. So my question is, timing on pruning the PG types and how much?
Well, as far as the paniculatas, they bloom in late summer and then get to be very large shrubs. But they also bloom on new wood. So you can still prune them in the spring perfectly fine. They'll still bloom in late summer. But they are a much bigger shrub. And typically you kind of prune them to kind of shape them a little bit. But beyond that, there's no need to do severe pruning, not at all.
Okay, but am I doing the correct thing on the Annabelles or the arborescence?
Oh,
by pruning clear to the ground?
Right. Most people do that. Much nicer, neater plant when you do that. So just prune them right down into the ground.
Most of it's dead to the ground anyway in the spring.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Angela. 866-780-9100 is the number. Carl is on the line in Wellman. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, hello.
What's your question?
Sustaining member.
Thanks.
I hope other ones do that. I had the opportunity to mill out quite a bit of walnut over the winter, and I'm wondering if there's any issue with the toxins in it for using the shavings from mulch. It's coarser than a sawdust, but less than wood chips.
I probably would not, because the wood does contain juglone, which may affect the growth of some plants. So I would prefer not to. Not by itself. If it were a small component of various tree species, I probably would. But if it's mainly just walnut, I probably would not.
Well, thank you very much. That's very good advice. I was going to plant a few hundred trees this year, and I'd hate to kill them all.
Right. Yeah, that would be a real bummer. Thank you so much for your call, Carl. Next up, we'll go to Bob in Des Moines. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Thanks, Charity. I've got a row of about 50 foot long of large honeysuckle that I want to kill, I want to get rid of. And I can't afford to hire it done professionally, you know, like with a bulldozer ripping them out. So how do I get rid of those? I thought about cutting them down low to the ground, but then they'll just keep growing up again. So what do I do after I cut them down? Do I pour a certain chemical on them, or how do I kill those things from coming back up?
What I would do is cut them back to the ground and then immediately apply a Roundup to the cut surface. And so what I would do, is get like a foam type paintbrush, pour some of the Roundup into a small container, and then as soon as you cut it off, apply the Roundup directly to the cut surface. Roundup is systemic, and it goes right down into the root system, and it kills the root system, so it shouldn't come back up. So,
and this is a very, very targeted way to deliver.
Yes, very good way of doing it, I think, yes.
All right, because you're not going to end up overspraying and damaging other plants and things in the area. That's something a lot of people struggle with, Bob. I'm sure you get a lot of questions about trying to get rid of honeysuckle, Richard.
That and sometimes privet and sometimes even lilacs.
It'll probably take a little bit of persistence, too. You might have to do it a couple of times before the root system is completely gone.
But do it immediately after the cut, within like 15, 20 minutes.
All right, Bob, good luck with that. Doug is on the line next in Mount Vernon. Hi, Doug.
Hello. We have 26 apple trees. We trimmed them last year. They hadn't been trimmed for many, many years. We had a bumper crop of apples. So that's one question. What do I do with those apple trees this year? So how much trimming should we do? We trimmed them pretty good top and...
Okay. Well, again, I would prune out any suckers at the base. If you have any what I would call defects, like branches growing inward, I would remove those. If those are not present, then I would simply do maybe some minor thinning, some very light thinning.
Okay. And we also have an 80 to 90 foot dawn redwood tree. And those, it has so many little tiny, it's almost like a redwood bush all the way up to the top. You know, what do you do with that? You just let them go. It's a beautiful tree.
As far as the branches near the ground,
Near the ground, yeah. Go ahead.
I would be inclined to leave them. I think they look great with the branches right down to the ground. Now, you can prune them if you wish. That's a personal choice, but I think they really look neat with the branches right down to the ground.
Yeah, all of our, we have 200-year-old Norwegian spruce, and we leave them right to the ground. They look beautiful that way.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Especially with the icicles on them. They look like decoration.
Yeah. Nice. Sounds like you've got some beautiful trees, Doug. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Jerry in Grinnell. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I inherited a plum and a cherry tree that are badly in need of pruning, and I'm wondering if it's too late in the season to prune.
No, not yet.
It's just right.
Yeah. Right.
It's exactly the right time.
I think this is a great time because it's also great for the gardener. It's not as cold as February.
Right. You basically want to do it before they start to break bud, where you can start to see some green tissue coming out of the buds. So you have at least 2 or 3 weeks. I would just wait until you have a fairly nice weekend and go out and do it.
Yeah. Great. Thank you.
All right. Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Jerry. 866-780-9100. With me today, Richard Duran, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist, and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. Kayla is on the line next in Mason City. Hi, Kayla.
Hello. My question is, I have decided that I'm going to have my own garden this year. I've always watched my mom do it, and I'm really advantageous and want to do my own. So my question is, when is the best time to till up that land, and do I need to do it multiple times and add fertilizer to it?
Fall would have been the best time, last fall.
When is the second best time?
Oh, no.
Kayla's ready to work.
But you can do it this spring, as soon as the ground is workable, early to mid-April.
Mm-hmm.
You want to destroy what's currently growing there. And then what I'd probably do is just apply like a 10-10-10, which is an all-purpose garden fertilizer, before you plant.
Okay.
About 1 to 2 pounds per 100 square feet. work that in, till that in, and go ahead and plant.
Great, thank you so much.
As far as a site, basically what you need is a site that receives at least 6 hours of direct sun each day, so plenty of sun, and a well-drained soil. If you have those two things, you should be in good shape.
All right, thank you so much.
Good luck, Kayla. I hope it's a fun spring and summer. Next up, we've got Kevin in Washington. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Sure. I love your show.
Thanks. What's your question?
I started an asparagus patch last spring, and now I don't know what, I mean, how do I care for it this spring? I know I can't harvest it yet, but
yeah.
Do I cut that dead stuff down or just
Absolutely.
Let it go?
Right. Sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks, cut down the dead debris. And this year, the main thing is keeping the weeds out. So I would go on a regular basis and do some very shallow hoeing and hand pulling. Take care of that. And then next year, you should be ready to go as far as harvest.
Next year, I can do a limited amount.
Oh, I would say you can do probably several weeks. I would guess 4 to 6 weeks next year.
Wow, that's good news. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for your call, Kevin. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. We've got Mariana on the line in Indianola next. Hello, Mariana.
Hi. I've got a question about my redwood tree. It's very old. I want to say the trunk, I'm not good with measurements, but the trunk is probably like a foot and a half. In diameter, and it's got like three trunks coming out of it. So, and it's also like one of the trunks, it looks like the bark is stripped pretty much almost all the way up to the, well, two-thirds of the way up. It looks kind of reddish. It did bloom last year. I did have some pruning done. But I've also got, I don't know anything about trees. I've got some huge, there were some branches cut off, and now I have, like, holes where the branches were cut off in the trunk of the tree. Probably, I think the biggest, I'm looking at it right now, the biggest hole is probably at least 2 inches in diameter, 2-3 inches
sure.
in diameter. So I'm wondering what I should do with it. I love it.
Right.
Yeah.
So, you know, the short answer is you probably don't need to do a whole lot with it. As the tree ages, it does tend to lose some bark. It's not uncommon for branches to die within a red bud. That's pretty common. And anything that's dead, you should remove. I think after that, you know, in terms of the pruning wounds or the holes that you're seeing, there's nothing to paint on those or anything like that. In fact, sometimes those tars and paints can actually cause more harm than good. They're holding in moisture and some of these other things that can cause or accelerate decay in the tree. I'm not as worried about structural issues with redbud because the tree just isn't as large. You know, it's not going to get so big that it's going to fall and break the roof of your garage or something like that. And so the three trunks don't bother me as much, or the three major stems don't bother me as much on a tree of this size. And so I wouldn't be surprised if the one that's losing bark is starting to die. So keep an eye on it. And if you notice that it doesn't leaf out or leafs out very poorly this spring, you could remove it. But otherwise, I don't know that there's much else to do to the tree, but enjoy it when it blooms.
Oh, okay. And what if, like, I did have a fairly large branch, like, break off during a storm.
Yeah.
And so should I, like, trim that?
Cleaning it up is a good thing. It allows a nice clean cut in the right spot, right at the base, not a flush cut, but leaving behind that collar and that ridge is a nice thing to do because it allows the plant to more quickly kind of seal that wound over. When there's something jagged left behind, it takes a lot longer for the tree to do that. So cleaning up those cuts, and you can do that now, is a good idea on any tree.
All right, Mariana, thank you so much for your call. Let's slip in one more question before the break. Tim in Ankeny says, last year, my six-year-old linden tree got hit hard twice by Asian beetles. Is there anything, I assume he means Japanese beetles, is there anything I can do this year to minimize damage during the upcoming growing season?
Boy, not much, unfortunately. You really can't affect the Japanese beetle population, but once they come, you could use some type of insecticide, but you're going to have to spray often to accomplish anything. I would be inclined just to ignore it, unfortunately. Just, it's not going to kill the tree, and that's the bottom line.
All right. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment with me, Iowa State University Extension Horticulture Specialist Richard Duran and Aaron Stile, Assistant Director of Ryman Gardens in Ames. They're here to answer your questions. Talk of Iowa at iowapublicradio.org is our email address, our phone number, 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's our home improvement day today. Home improvement expert Bill McAnally is here today to answer your questions. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Bill, you wanted to circle back to talking about the vaporizers.
Yeah.
And that's something so many of us need in the winter. A dry cough can really make things tough.
I know it is. And that's why I wanted to revisit Barb's question, because this is so hard for people because, I mean, I remember when I was young, we'd have that basically like look like an aquarium, you know, the old vaporizers. Yeah, for a dry cough. And, I think what maybe the best thing to do, and I'm just kind of spitballing here, but is, you know, get with the doctor and ask, is there any other way to, you know, address in being able to get more vapor into your system and, you know, to alleviate the drying. You know, I was just kind of envisioning, you know, a lot of people use a CPAP, you know, basically a headgear, you know, that helps people with sleep apnea. And so you've got air coming in all the time. And I would think there'd be something that you could wear to bring in, you know, the moisture to yourself rather than putting into the room. Because,
all right, so if it's serious enough problem that you need, yes, this, you think that you also need to protect your house.
Well, yeah, because here's the case. Because you're trying to help yourself, but if you start adding excess moisture, especially if there's a chance there's any dew point possibilities, whether it's in the carpet right next to an outside wall, in many cases there's a tremendous areas for air leaks. I've been in houses where I've taken my temperature sensor and I'll be looking at the walls and it's 70 degrees. And I was in one not long ago where I went down by the floor and it was windy that day and it was 22 degrees. So there was so much air leakage. Well, if that high moisture level meets that cold, well, there might be some things growing in on that carpet, and getting that into your lungs along with the moisture could make the whole situation even worse. So, you know, I would ask a doctor, say, you know, I really don't want to be pumping all this moisture into my house walls, and it's very possible, and it sounds nasty, and it can be even worse. That just scares me, and they always have. Same thing with humidifiers; they always just scare the heck out of me.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Michelle is on the line in Altoona. Hi, Michelle.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
You
what's
bet.
Your question?
Okay, my question is: our house was built in 1913, and the owners before us built on, or took the built-on garage and or attached garage and turned it into a what we call a great room. It's got a little fireplace and all that good stuff. Well, what they left was a window that was a window to the outside, and it comes in the house through our stairway that goes up to the second floor. So I have this window that serves no purpose other than looking out on the attic.
Okay.
So, actually, this is terrible, but I have a tap hanging over it. But my question is, could we remove that window and just drywall over it? I've been told I can't, so I haven't. But I'm just wondering.
So you're looking into the garage attic then, right?
Yeah.
Is the garage have a ceiling in it? I mean, obviously, I guess it does because it's a great room now. What a bozo.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, the only reason that I can think of that you couldn't is maybe for fire issues, but, you know, you have a ceiling down below. You just treat it just like an exterior wall. So I would, you know, I would frame it in and put, me personally, I'd put at least 1 inch of, you know, sheet foam, like extruded foam, like the blue, green, pink stuff. And seal it, air seal it, and then cover it with 5/8 gypsum board.
5/8 gypsum board.
Right, okay. And then seal around that as well to make sure that with a good polyurethane caulking. This is on the garage side that I'm saying. Garage side, right. And then on the inside of it, be just insulate. You can just take some fiberglass bats, cut them perfectly to fit in between all of your framing members, and then go ahead and put on some, I'd put another layer of 5/8 sheetrock just to play it safe. You can run this by your building inspector.
Good idea. Okay.
Just to play it safe, you know, because because you may have in your area, you may have, in Altoona, they may have something specific, especially on remodeling and fire, because every town has a little different outlook. And so I'd run it by them and get their opinion on how they want that done, because you should get a permit for that as well. Just run it by them. They're very helpful usually. Altoona's got some good inspectors.
Yeah, they do. And I will definitely do that. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for your call, Michelle. Next up, we've got Harvey in Mason City. Hi, Harvey.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm thinking of replacing the shower stall in my bathroom. I've seen these prefab shower stalls with plastic walls that imitate tile with grout.
Yep.
Are those durable for the long term or not?
Well, they are. Here we go. Are you looking at one like that's like 100 and some bucks, or one that's like 500 and some bucks?
Well, I really don't know, because I haven't looked into it enough yet.
Well,
I'm not trying to save money. I want a good one.
Okay.
You know?
Some of them, the higher end ones are pretty doggone good, because it's solid plastic, or usually polyvinyl, give you that tile look. Now the cheaper ones have it's kind of a masonite base, which is wood fiber, and then they have a thin covering that makes it look like tile. Now I remember we used to put that on, they used to call it Marlite. We used to put that in showers back in the 70s. That lasted about 2 years. But the good high-end ones, putting one in for my daughter, and that one is going to hold up for, 50 years. It's just how you attach it and make sure that you use the right adhesives and the right caulking that the manufacturer has. And I keep reiterating back to the manufacturer. But that's the key point, because what it gets glued to or adhered to, if that's not solid, then this whole thing's going to peel off. And so it will give you a suggestion whether it wants moisture-resistant drywall behind there, or if it wants some other product to adhere these panels to. Because in many cases, they don't want to just go ahead and adhere it to painted drywall, for instance. Because you may start getting some softening of the drywall behind it. That's really the biggest key is what you adhere it to. The product itself should be fine. I like a lot of them. Oh, and then when you put the base down, be sure and put cement, mix up some pre-mixed concrete, and put that underneath where you're standing, so when you set the base down that there's no flex in the base. So when you step on it, it doesn't flex. That's about the only other thing. But most of them are pretty nice, and make sure you have nailers, which would be wood, some wood built in into the wall where you can attach the actual wall section, because some of them, the ones that I'm thinking of have to screw to the wall in some areas. Make sure there's wood back there and not just screw it into drywall.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Harvey. Next up, we've got Gene in Ames. Hi, Gene. Gene, are you there? All right, I think
quiet.
We've lost Gene. Let's give Phil a try in Des Moines. Hi, Phil.
Good morning. I'm building a new single-story home with a vaulted main room, and kind of wondering if there'd be any pro or con against, in addition to whatever insulation the contractor is planning to put up, and the the roof will be well insulated and vented, et cetera. But adding like an inch of foil-faced polyiso insulation over all the ceiling surfaces so we could, you know, really tape the seams and have that extra insulation and also break off the cold, the cold bridge.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, that's usually what I do on projects and on my own house as well. And my vaulted ceiling is I didn't use polyiso. I used extruded foam. And I put the 1 inch on the bottom to cut down that thermal bridging. And what's really funny is, you know, the ones that I've worked on and we've done that way, we haven't seen the drywall crack at the ridge like you see in a lot of houses.
Oh.
You know, and you go in and I always, that's one of the things I go in when I have a vault, I always look up there and see if the tape's coming down or something. That, you know, I think people don't give enough credit to that slowing of that, you know, thermal bridging. I think that should be a, you know, it is recommended, but I'd love to see that required sometime where they put at least 1 inch, like an R5 continuous underneath and taped like what you're saying. And that way, you know, the performance of the whole envelope is so much better. Are you going to put can lights in?
Yes.
Okay, take a look at the LED surface mounts rather than the can lights, because can lights are so hard to air seal. When they say they're airtight, you know, it'll say,
right.
Insulation, ICAT, insulation contact, airtight. When you go in there with an infrared camera, you'll find out how airtight they are. So take a look at the new LEDs, because they just hook right into, a 4-inch box, a standard box, which you can air seal completely. Now, I always use, like, CertainTeed membrane, which is a forgivable vapor retarder, over the whole ceiling, but if you can put that up and the foam, or in many cases, you know, you can just put the foam up. But we got to remember, though, all of those foams tend to shrink over time a little bit. And if you put the foil face one on the bottom, that's an absolute vapor barrier, and usually that doesn't shrink.
Oh, okay.
But I would take a look. Go to Green Building Advisor or Building Science Corporation, and I could see you're familiar with them.
Joe
Stieberick. Yeah, Joe Stieberick, and then Peter Yost does Green Building Advisor and Martin Holiday. But Peter Yost, I've worked with him before on presentations and stuff, and he's really good resource as well. So I would kind of, because he does a lot of testing as well. So take a look at either one of those two sites. I really like what Peter Yost does. And as well as for everybody, download a Construction Instruction. It's a free app. I think it's the most popular construction app now that there is. And it shows all these things in animations. So, I'd get that app, too. That's Marco Liberté
and
Justin Wilson, that bunch of guys. So, yeah, that's what you're doing is the right thing. I mean, I'm glad you're doing it that way. That sounds good.
Cool.
All right. Yep. Thanks a lot for your call, Phil. Let's get to some email questions here. Hopefully a few quick ones. This one's from David in Iowa City. I was told that the injected foam exterior wall insulation turns to powder over the years. Is that true?
The old formaldehyde stuff, yeah, it turned to powder and it would shrink. And the thing is, you hit it like with a garden hose and it just washes away. It had no stability, not to mention it had the formaldehyde, which was really bad. Some of the injectables, this is kind of a touchy area to say on air, but there you really need to research the companies that are using the injectables. Because in many cases we've gone back and friends of mine have gone back and looked inside the walls and did infrared scans of the walls and such, maybe in many cases, 50% of the area was filled in. Hmm. Other areas, it was just, you're wasting your money.
So when you say do your research, how do you know?
Well, you're going to have to get a lot of references and ask them, you know, how do you make sure that whole cavity is being filled? Are you poking holes every once in a while, which is kind of a joke? Are you using infrared? Because that's the only one that's,
okay.
And in an infrared, the downside is if there's not much temperature difference between inside and outside, it's sometimes kind of hard to get a scan. But that is really scary because there are some companies around that are doing this, and you're not getting what you paid for, is, I guess, the most politically correct way to
say
it.
All right, although a lot of people who are not getting what they paid for
don't
know.
They
don't
know.
So you can't depend on reviews.
Yeah, and that's where it's always hard. I mean, I know what company to do that I would never, hire. But, you can't say it. And that's always kind of hard. I would, if you're sitting here right with me probably, and say, don't record us, it's a different thing. But, I guess...
So do your research, look at those reviews, and ask about InfraRed.
And I would look at Department of Energy because I would look at those. And then there again, I think Green Building Advisor and Building Science Corporation, I think they've done some tests on some of these foams, and they'll do that. Also, there was an article not many months ago, I believe, that was in Fine Home Building that showed some of them. But if they're really trying to push about how they're going to save you a whole ton of energy, usually I step back when they make claims that, especially that we're going to save you 50% on energy. Well, first of all, you're only going to save me maybe at best 50% on my heating and cooling, not my total utility bill, because how are you going to save me any electricity on my computers?
So if it sounds too good to be true,
in many
cases
it is.
Flag.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. I wish there was a tactful way to say that, but.
And there's obviously such thing as a short answer. Let's try this
one. Yes, okay. Thank you. Dig me out of this thing, will you?
Does the pink accordion foam that they put under vinyl siding have any insulating value?
It's got a little. But mostly it's there for keeping the siding nice and straight and level.
All right.
And well, that's always been a big one for me. You're going to say, I got to save you a ton of energy. No, you're putting it on there most of the time because it levels the siding, makes the siding look better. If you're putting a quarter inch of insulation on there, you're getting about an R value of 1.
Okay.
So...
It's not doing any damage.
Usually not. It depends on usually who puts it on. See, that's where there again, building science kind of scares you sometimes.
Right,
but it's better if they're going to do that. Why not just have them put 1 inch over the whole thing, and then you've got an airtight wall, and you've added an R5, which is continuous insulation. But I have seen cases where you've added that little bit of quarter. And there's been some moisture issues.
Okay.
Just saying.
Let's try this for a quick question before we have to go. From Don, I'm interested in information about the tabs that can be installed on a steel roof to prevent the snow from sliding off. My house has a steel roof, and the snow slides off the roof in front of the doors. What do you think about those?
They're very good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Easy answer.
Yes, easy.
Quick question.
Especially if you have a hidden fastener steel roof, one that doesn't have all the screws showing all over the place, because... if you didn't put the screws down right and you stop it, and then you might get a leak. So usually they're put on the hidden faster ones, standing seams.
All right. Bill McAnally.
This is a tough day.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there were a lot of questions we didn't have time to answer, but you'll come back again next month.
Yes.
Thank you so much for being here today, sir.
Thank you.
Our home improvement expert, Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa is produced by Iowa Public Radio. Our producers are Dennis Reese, Lindsay Moon, Ben Stanton, and Emily Woodbury. We had production assistance today from Sean McLean. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.